Morning.
Good morning.
There are a few more seats in here if any of you want to come in here. There's a cushion right here, and well, maybe that's about it. There's a cushion there if somebody would like to sit on it. So this morning I'm going to talk about three attitudes toward enlightenment in Zen. Two of these come out of Chinese Zen practice, and one of them comes out of Japanese Zen practice. And as you can see from your, I think you can see on your flyer, I'm referring to them as the bright mirror, the shattered mirror, and no mirror. So I'm going to start by talking about the bright mirror. And I've talked about these three before, but I've never talked about them together in one talk. So this is our first. The bright mirror. So the bright mirror really in China is based on ancient Chinese tradition of doing Zen meditation, doing sitting meditation, right? And the famous bright mirror poem that was written by Shen Shui. The body is the awakening tree. The mind, the mirror bright. Take care to keep it clean and let no dust alight. Shen Shui's poem. And that attitude is William Blake's attitude when he says what? He says, if the doors of perception were to be cleansed, we would see everything as it is, infinite. Infinite. So that practice of sitting in meditation over and over and over again is our practice of wiping clean the mirror from all that dust, all that residue, all of those worries, all of those heartaches, all of that stuff, over and over and over again. And it's called the bright mirror because at some point we feel its luminosity. And its luminosity penetrates everything, everything. And this is the path in traditional Buddhism from delusion, here in the left hand, I guess, to enlightenment in the right hand, or whatever. It's the path. From one to the other. And we do it over and over and over again. That's one thing that William Blake did not emphasize. We do it because it's a practice that takes a lot of effort. And dust is always accumulating. And anxieties are always coming up. So that spirit of repetition is how we get from the right hand to the left hand. I'm changing because I'm left-handed, so right. Right hand to the left hand on this kind of somewhat arduous path, somewhat boring path, somewhat redundant path. Because here we are again. Here I am again. This morning, this evening, doing the same practice over and over again, over and over again. And when I talk about this, sometimes I say it's not that different from learning to play a musical instrument or learning a foreign language. My daughter, we began sending my daughter to French camp when she was 8 years old. Little Concordia French camp, right? And she didn't seem to learn much of anything. But we kept sending her every year. She liked going. But she didn't especially learn any French, right? And she took French in high school, but she wasn't especially good at French. But I heard her every morning going over her vocabulary. And, you know, Linda, my wife, was really good at French, and she kind of would cringe when she would listen to her. But, you know, we just encouraged her. We just encouraged her. And then she went to college and took French, and she didn't do very well in French. But she just kept at it. She just did it. And then after college, she got a chance to go into the Peace Corps. And she thought, oh, I'll go to a French-speaking country. They'd like me because of my French. Well, I don't know about that. But anyway, then she got sent to English-speaking part of Africa. But she made friends. Her best friend in the Peace Corps was a woman who was fluent in French. So every day, they spoke a little French out in the middle of nowhere in Botswana, just the two of them. In between that time, she had spent time in France. But again, it had been hard for her. Well, now, for those of you who know me, she lives in France, and people don't know she's American. But how many years later? How much effort? How much practice? How much boredom? How much frustration? To get from delusion to enlightenment. So that's the first approach. And the second approach is the no mirror approach, right? And that's the poem of Wei Ning. I mean, it's just an example, right? This permeates Chinese Zen, but this is an example. Wei Ning, who was the young smart-aleck, huh? Young smart-ass. And he said, after he heard his elder's poem, he said, the body is not the awakening tree, nor the mind a mirror bright. Since the first no thing exists, where can dust alight? Since the first no thing exists, where can dust alight? This is a second approach to enlightenment. And this approach, enlightenment is always here. It's not over there or over here. It's always here. But we're covering it up with all of our complaining, with all of our meowing and meandering. If we're not meandering, we're meowing. If we're not meowing, we're meandering. On and on and on. And yet it's here. It's always here. It's not there. It's not at the end of 33 years of arduous practice. It's right here. Always here. It was here before Adam and Eve ate the tree of good from the apple. They didn't eat the tree when they ate the apple of good and evil. It was here. Before we divide things up, before we get all carried away, it's always here. Always. And all we have to do is come back to this original beginner's mind, as Suzuki Roshi would say. Innocence, as the Bible would say. And it's not a long path. It's just right here. So it doesn't require years of sitting. I think you guys would want to do this one, right? It doesn't require any sitting at all. It doesn't matter what posture you take. I mean, you could stand on your head. Or you can do calypso dancing. Because it's here. It's here. And Wei Ning is the hero in Chinese Zen of this approach to enlightenment, of the uncovering approach, the letting go approach, the not trying to go anywhere approach. And so Wei Ning is portrayed in the Chinese commentary as being illiterate. Because you don't have to learn anything to do this. You don't have to know anything. You don't have to become a master of anything. And he's portrayed as not having had any experience doing zazen. You don't know have to do that. Because when you do meditation, often you're trying to get something. You're trying to get somewhere. But it's already here. And Wei Ning just woke up to it by stopping, looking, and listening. It's just such a cliche in our culture to stop, look, and listen. But how often do we really do it? Do we really do it? And when we do, we discover undividedness. Undividedness. So the first half of the Platform Sutra by Wei Ning is very frustrating if you want some ideas about how to deepen your practice, because he just keeps saying, I'll just return to this. We'll just let go of all those things you've learned. Well, don't try to sit to get anything. Over and over and over again. And then the second half, he changes, but I'm not going to get into that today. So both of these approaches say that this is about self-emptying. And in one of them, there's a path, like the 10 ox herding pictures. You know the 10 ox herding pictures, some of you? The first ox herding picture is looking for the ox. The second ox herding picture, I don't remember all 10, is seeing a trace of the ox. The third one is actually seeing the ox. The fourth one is getting up close to the ox. The fifth one is maybe riding the ox. I'm not going to do all 10, right? the sixth one is become befriending the ox, so when you're riding it, it's no longer bucking you. And then the next one is nothing, emptiness. There's nothing there on the page. And then the last one, what's happening? The guy is back in the marketplace. The ox is gone, and he's hanging out with the wine bibbers and the prostitutes and the peace demonstrators and the cops. He's hanging out with all of them. You can see what I've got on my mind. He's hanging out with all of them. Pardon?
What were you doing last week?
Well, I'll get to that in a minute. But both of them say that. Both of them say that once we self-empty, once we are able to self-empty, we can be immersed in delusion and completely free of it. Completely free of it. So those are the first two. And there are limitations to those, as there are limitations to any approach to anything, right? First, both of them have a pretty big division between things as they appear to be and things as they are. And there's a pretty big division between the world as we create it and the world as it is. But that's a limitation also, because sometimes then we tend to discount things as they appear to be. We tend to put it down as if it's inferior. So that's a slight limitation. A second limitation is that both of these approaches emphasize and value the pre-discriminating mind, the extra-discriminating mind, at the expense of the discriminating mind. The pre-discriminating mind is privileged. The extra-discriminating mind is privileged. Through Zazen, you will become a privileged being. Or if you're doing Wei Nang's thing, all you have to do is stop seeing, stop looking, listen. The privilege. Well, as soon as something is privileged, we should be careful about that idea, about that sense of being privileged, because there's always a downside to existing in some paradisical state, if I'm pronouncing it right. Always some downside to that kind of a teaching, right? Wonderful. But. So, these two approaches, discriminations, sometimes become neutralized, and so do activities which support discriminating activities. Science, reason, logic, thinking, intellect, those get a little disparaged a little bit, right? Those aren't so important. Those are maybe unnecessary. So there's a limitation there. I mean, after all, we're thinking beings. We're creating beings. Our science is quite fascinating and helps us in many ways. Our logic, where would we be without our logic? We are logic-making beings. Now, fourth limitation is the limitation of It's the limitation from the from the division between enlightened people and unenlightened people, right? So on the one hand, in the first one, we move from delusion to enlightenment, and then there are those enlightened people who, after 33 years, and then the rest of you who are delusioned, or the rest of us who are delusioned, right? Or in the second one, there are people like Hui Neng who know beginner's mind, and they're really enlightened, and you want to hang out with them, but even though you've been practicing for 33 years, you're not enlightened. You've got the same old crap going over and over and over. So that tends to disempower people. That tends to put the power all in a few others, a few great bodhisattvas. And I knew my teacher, Suzuki Roshi, he was just regular, but he became bigger and bigger and bigger. When Thich Nhat Hanh came here in 1980, he was just a teacher. Katagiri said to me, Katagiri Roshi, oh, you should pay attention to this man. He is deep. Nobody had ever heard of him in this country. And now, and look at the Dalai Lama. Look at the Dalai Lama. Deities. Well, as soon as we create deities, what happens? We disempower ourselves. And we also set them up to fail in a way. That is, if we look closely at them. But often we don't, because we're caught by our mythology. So those are limitations of the first two. And now we have Dogen coming along in China, in Japan. He's gone to China, he's come back to Japan, and his third one is what I'm calling the shattered mirror. So the first one was the bright mirror, the second one is no mirror at all, the third is the shattered mirror. So Dogen says, the greatly enlightened person in question is not someone who is greatly enlightened from the beginning. So he's critiquing the second one, the no mirror one, the Hui Neng one, that we're enlightened before we were born. All we have to do is tap into it anytime. And we don't do anything. We make no effort to do that. So long as we're making effort, we're distracting ourselves from just being it. But he's saying that's fallacious. And he's saying, nor is the person someone who gets and appropriates enlightenment. So then he's critiquing the bright mirror one. You don't get it and appropriate it through all your 33 years of sitting every day and going to retreat after retreat. You don't get it. Because for Dogen, delusion is not the absence of enlightenment. Enlightenment is not the absence of delusion. On the contrary, they are two sides of one coin. And what Zen practice is about is learning to be intimate with delusion. Enlightenment is intimate with delusion. We shed light on our delusions. And that's what Zen practice is about. Shedding calm, clear, still, unwavering light on delusion. So Dogen says, you should know that to understand that a greatly enlightened, you should know that a greatly enlightened person is nevertheless deluded, and to understand that is the quintessence of practice. Great enlightenment is ever intimate with the nevertheless deluded. So for this approach, the boundaries are always there. Within so-called duality, non-duality, there is duality. There's always duality. Yet it's provisional. It's permeable. It's flexible. It's not something to get all hung up on. So delusion and enlightenment for Dogen have no fixed nature. They're tools to guide us. They're focal points. And, sorry to say, that delusion doesn't collapse in an awakened life. It doesn't collapse. Sorry. Sorry for me. Sooner or later, sorry for you guys. Enlightenment illuminates delusion. it illuminates delusion. And Heejin Kim says, enlightenment illuminates delusion the way the moon illuminates the earth, the trees, the sky, the houses, the people on a dark night. And that's what enlightenment does. So the analogy that I use I've used a lot, is the analogy of a cave. We bring our bare attention, we bring our bare awareness into the cave. We enlighten the cave. And the cave goes on forever. It goes on forever. There are always new nooks of anxiety, nooks, crannies of trepidation in the cave. And we bring our light into it. We bring our steady, calm light into it. We just bring it in. We don't know anything. We just bring it in. Penetrating to the depths of it. Penetrating, it's all of its dimensions, but we never end. We never end because there's always a new doubt. There's always a new anxiety. There's always a new fear. It's part of being human. It's the human situation. It's the human condition. And if you think that that's not true for the Dalai Lama or Thich Nhat Hanh, you are dumb. You are dumb. You are living in a hippie mythy world. And you can live in that hippie mythy world all you want. But you might as well let it go, I think. Might as well let it go. So, in my life right now, I like to give examples, right? So in my life right now, I'm dealing with a situation that's a little scary for me. I have a sister with schizophrenia who lives in another part of the country, and her schizophrenia, she is one of these people who was treatment for her schizophrenia never really helped her. There's about 10-15% of people with schizophrenia, the meds don't help very much. And they continue to be delusional and disoriented for their entire lives. And my sister is one of those people, and she's getting older. And her caretaker is getting really old, and her son is growing up, so I'm thinking about, geez, I should bring her here to Minneapolis. But I have a lot of worries about that, a lot of worries, partly based on my own issues with her, with what happened to her when she was 19, with how I dealt with that or didn't deal with that. And, you know, the interesting thing about me is that I direct an agency that serves people with schizophrenia, but then my own sister, well, that's so close to home. That brings up all of my issues from my adolescence and from my young adulthood, and when she had her break, and from the years. So can I go into that nook of the cave, or am I going to have to split? We always want to split. It doesn't matter. We want to split. But that's not enlightenment. You have your light. I have my light. All I have to do is enlighten that cranny. And when the anxiety comes up, I just let it come up, and I continue to explore. Not intellectually, not with my head, but with my being, with my bare attention, with my kind awareness. What is this here? What is this hesitation about? What is this anxiety about? And as you do that, it begins to dissolve. And then, fortunately or unfortunately, there's another cranny that you haven't seen before. And luckily, this flashlight never runs out of batteries. I promise you that. It never runs out of batteries. You're afraid it's going to run out. You say, oh, I got to get out of this cave before it runs out. It doesn't run out of batteries. Not bare attention. Not open, still awareness. It doesn't run out of batteries. So Dogen says, when the Dharma does not yet completely fill your body-mind, you think that it is already sufficient. When the Dharma fills your body-mind, you think that something is missing. So as you become more and more aware of your frailties, of your inadequacies, Dogen says, you see more and more that enlightenment is ever intimate with delusion. So the two exist as interplay. Not an adhesion, not unity, not oneness. We talk so much about unity and oneness in Zen, but you won't find Dogen using the word oneness or unity. I mean, I haven't found it. Interplay. So enlightenment sensitizes us to the complexities and the problems of what it is to live. It sensitizes us to those. So that instead of trying to get away from them or overcome them or figure out how to do them, we're with them. We're just with them. And so Dogen says, a greatly enlightened person is nevertheless deluded, and that is the quintessence of practice. So I've told this story before about being at the Zen monastery that I spent time at when I was young, Tassajara Zen Monastery, and having wonderful openings there. Actually, I haven't told this story exactly. No, I haven't told this one. Well, okay. I can't even remember what I've told and haven't told. So, having great openings there, and then I went home to my house, and to my mother's house, and my sister had just had her first psychotic breaks. So, and I went over and I went home in some kind of beatific state. I just sailed home from Tassajara. I was in the car, but I was just sailing. And then I got to my home, and there was my mother distraught. And there was a strange woman who looked like my sister. And my mother said she was my sister, but she didn't act like my sister. She talked about going out to play like we did when we were 5 years old. She talked about the woman who lived next door when we were 5 years old, and could we go out and see Noreen together. So, my, where did my enlightenment go? Where does our enlightenment go? Where does our calmness go? And just be with it, but I didn't know how. So I stayed only a half day at my mom's house, and I rushed back to Tassajara because I just was totally mixed up, and I was mad at my teacher. I don't know why I was mad at him. Well, I know why I was mad at him. And I went in and I saw him, and I said, something like, well, I had all these great openings and I practiced just the way you said, and it was wonderful. Then I went back and it's not wonderful at all. And he said, you've heard me say this before. He said, oh, I know just what you mean. It's like that for me too. He did. He said that. And he said, now that I have been practicing all these years, he said, I am more sensitive than I ever was. And so when I do something that is unkind, I feel that it's awful. He said, I never did before. So, Dogen talks about a famous Chinese story about mirrors. This talk, I guess, is all about mirrors. And he gives two interpretations, and then he gives his own interpretation. And the first story about mirrors is the monk asked Hua Yan, what is it like when a greatly enlightened person is nevertheless deluded? Okay, here we are again. What is it like when a greatly enlightened person is nevertheless deluded? Huan Yin answers, a shattered mirror never reflects again. A fallen flower never returns to the tree. So here we have the Chinese interpretation, which Dogen is going to turn upside down. But this is the Chinese interpretation that once we have cleansed ourselves, and there's no self even left to cleanse, and we're just openness and self-emptying, that we're A-OK for the rest of our lives. And the early Chinese commentators talked about this poem in that way. But this poem is also talked about in Japan, and it's talked about in the Kamakura period in Japan, which is the period Dogen lived in. And the Kamakura period in Japan was a time of great chaos. Great chaos. There were civil wars. The monks were fighting each other. The emperor seemed to have lost his power. So it was considered a dark time in Buddhist practice. A very dark time. And many teachers, Shinran and Honen, said that this is the third phase of Buddhist practice. Some of you know this, that Buddha himself supposedly, in one of the sutras, I mean, he said so many things in different sutras, you can find just about anything, but I found this. In one of the sutras, he talked about the three ages. He said, for the first 500 years after my death, people will really practice. People will really embrace the Dharma. They will really imbibe it. But then in the second 500 years, things will start to fall in decay. So people will listen to the Dharma a lot, but they won't really embody it. They won't really embrace it. And then he said by that third 500 years, which will actually last for 10,000 years, the Dharma will be in total disarray. So Dogen, who is living in the 1200s, hears these Buddhist teachers saying, oh, this is the third period. We're in the last period. So this story about a shattered mirror never reflecting again, a fallen flower never returning to the tree, just means that these little enlightened experiences you have aren't going to affect your life. That everybody is in this century is taking advantage of everyone else. Everybody is hurting everyone else, and this is the fallen time. This is the fallen time. But, of course, Dogen rejected that, too. If Dogen hadn't rejected that, we wouldn't have had any Soto Zen. He said that's also just a fantasy, just a negative fantasy from the pessimism of the times. And we have our own times right here. You may think they're pessimistic, you may not, but they seem kind of pessimistic. Seems like kind of dark times to me. I'm a 60s person, right? I went to my first Vietnam War anti-war demonstration in what year. And it seemed like we were going to prevail. We had Martin Luther King. We had many things going for us. But then our country went the other way, far, far, far the other way, in terms of materialism, in terms of trying to boss around everybody else in the world, in terms of many, many things. And I had this feeling when I went to the peace demonstration on Labor Day. I have not been to peace demonstration in years. Right? Not in years. But my son said, come on, Dad. Go to this with me. And I said, well, Jed, I don't want to. But then I thought, well, I can put a light in that cave. You know, in that cranny. I don't have to run away from that cranny. I didn't run away from it when I was in my 20s. Why do I have to when I'm 65? You know, I can put a light there. And I said, okay, I'll go, Jed, but I don't want to get arrested. And he said, oh, Dad, don't be silly. So we went on our Labor Day march, and some of you were there. And it was good. I was really glad I did it. But I have to say that it was scarier than in the 60s, because there were huge phalanxes of police all over the place with riot gear staring us down. And I was scared. I didn't remember that from the 60s. Anything like that. Nothing. It seemed like there were more police in riot gear than there were us. And we were being calm. And then somebody said, we saw a little tear gas going off up a block from us. We didn't know why. We didn't know why it was going off. And we saw it. And, you know, and I just sort of, I could feel my constriction inside. And then there was this phalanx of police guys just looking at me with their riot gear on. And, here's my chance to practice, right? I've been teaching this Zazen practice for how many years? I've been practicing it for how many years? But I do feel my heart starting to get fast. So I just watch it. I just watch it. I just be with it. And then I hear one of the monitors say, "Whatever you do, don't run." So that monitor is my teacher, right? That monitor is all of our teachers. Whatever you do, don't run. Just be with it. And so we did, and we were fine. In a way, this seems like, again, we are in the fallen age. We are in the Kamakura 21st century. It's totally fallen, only this time we're ruining our environment. In a Kamakura age, they could not destroy all human culture. They may have tried, but they couldn't. Now, we the way we're going, there may be a few human beings left. So we are in that age. Nevertheless, forget the age. The practice is what this is about. It's about the practice, finding your light. You have your light. Your light's here, finding it and shining it. Wherever you are, whatever you're in, and not running away. And then if you run away, when you're running, just running with the light. So that your running is loose, so it's open, so it's not anything other than just running. Just running. Then you won't hurt anybody, and you won't hurt it yourself. So I want to finish by just reviewing what I think are strengths of all three of these approaches, because it sounds like I'm only saying the last approach is good. But any approach to this opening up and settling down that we do is good. And I don't want to diss the Chinese teachers. The Chinese teachers are great. They're with us now. They're with us now. They never leave us, even in this desolate, screwed up age. Well, they'd be surprised, though, I think, if they came back and saw us. How we just don't take care of each other. We just don't take care of each other. So, just a couple minutes on the three approaches. The first approach. That's the approach of the mirror mind approach. You practice, you're moving from deluded state to enlightened state by practicing. By practicing, practicing, practicing. Day after day, retreat after retreat. You have to do retreats. 5 minutes a day for 30 years is not good enough. You have to do retreats too. You've got to really do it. How that approach helped me was that I was an ambitious person. Ambitious, quite competitive and quite ambitious. So here I can take a practice, I can put my ambition into something with a forward movement to it, and I can have a goal, and I can check in with my teachers anytime I'm having problems, and they can help me and encourage me to move from this deluded state to the enlightened state. And I can drive all desires into one, as they say. All my other desires for all the stuff that I wanted when I was in my teens. In my 20s, I tried to drive it into one. To drive it into one. And that helped. That helped a lot with my teacher Suzuki Roshi as the role model. And the second one, important too, very important, because the second one says, it complements the first one. It says, well, okay, but don't forget, Tim, that enlightened mind is always here, right in the middle of some cops even glaring at you, right in their guards, there's enlightenment. You know, they have these big face guards. You can see their faces completely. There's no, so it's totally open, totally open as you look into their fear, right there, right here. So we don't have to do anything, Tim. We don't have to struggle to be anybody. It's already here. And at any time that you feel like you're so far off from calmness, you can come back. You can remind yourself that the enlightened mind, if it exists at all, has to be omnipresent. It has to be. Or how could it be clear mirror? How could it be a bright mirror if it weren't always here? So that you don't need to think about 32 years of zazen or 32 minutes of zazen or purifying yourself or getting out of this bad habit that you have, because you can just come back to it. So that's helpful practice. Helpful practice. It's not practice in order to get anywhere, just to let the mirror shine. And then the third one, I think I've already said why it was helpful. But the third one, helpful to me, when I, after I left my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, some things happened at the Sangha which upset me just after I left, upset me a lot. It sort of made me question my teacher's judgment, and I had always put him on a pedestal. But after I left him, I started reading Dogen, and I never read Dogen during all the times I was with Suzuki Roshi. But I started reading Dogen about being enlightened within your delusion, and that enlightenment is never free of delusion. And so then I became forgiving of him and began to see him as a human being rather than as the great Suzuki Lama, Suzuki Roshi Lama, right? Worship Suzuki Roshi Lama. And no offense to the Tibetans, but that's what I went through. And then, when I came and I worked with Katagiri Roshi, I was much more balanced in my approach and not so like, he's got it and I don't. Just, we're here trying to manifest this light together. Whether there are two of us, three of us, 33 of us, we're trying to do this on this moment. And we don't have to look for the enlightened ones, because there are no ones. And then finally, in my own case, now that I'm a teacher, now that I'm an abbot and all that stuff, when I screw up, I think, oh, hey, there's another opportunity. And I really do say that. But I say this to people all the time, and they say, oh, it's just a cliche. But I do say that to myself. I need to remind myself that regardless of how deep I can go into samadhi here in front of the whatever, that wall, I guess we call it, right? The wall. That on the next moment, I may slip into being really feeling mean. Really feeling mean, and because I'm a human being, and all I have to do is be intimate with that sense of feeling mean, be intimate with it. And if I do that, then that enlightening of that meanness, it mellows it out until the next one comes. Until the next one comes. So I'm going to finish with another poem by Dogen. Dogen says, to what shall I liken the world? Moonlight reflected in dewdrops shaken from a crane's bill. So here Dogen is using the moonlight as enlightenment. Again, the moonlight shines on everything. It enlightens everything, even a dewdrop, even a blade of grass. Moonlight reflected in dewdrops shaken from a crane's bill. So this shaking is the shaking of life. This shattering of the mirror is the shattering mirror of life. The human predicament is to experience one shaking after another, one shattering after another. That's what your life is. If you think it is going to be any different, you better go to Mars. This is the human situation. This is the human condition. And that's where the moon shines. That's where the moon shines. Nowhere else, but right here in the midst of this shaking, in the midst of this shattering. So I think that's what I want to say for today. I'll be glad to entertain questions, comments, stories. Bill.
You were saying about how the flashlight, the battery.
Yeah, right.
And I guess what I'm... And about delusion, I'm curious about the delusion and dementia.
Delusion where?
Dementia.
Delusion as dementia. Something we may all be facing.
From what you're saying, it sounds like what's required is really inquiring mind.
That's right. So we would say that when someone is suffering from dementia, especially in their advanced states, that there really isn't any enlightenment. That there's no ability to just be there with it. That they're so. That would be the exception, and there are actually many exceptions. Dogen was more addressing himself to people who are practicing and still in their prime of life. That's what he's addressing. But there's no doubt that I could fall into dementia. I'm 65. I mean, and I could fall into dementia like at another 5 years, 10 years, hopefully not for 30 years, if at all. And I would not be able to shed much light on anything. And you should probably kick me out before it's too late, you know.
But you know, it creates a curious problem for all of this stuff because, you know, dementia, it has to be a continuum.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
You know what? Your mind, I'm sure, is sharper 10 years ago. You have insights that come with wisdom and aging.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're pretty valid.
Yeah.
But the quickness of your mind cannot be the same as it was.
That's right.
So that sort of viewed in that way, it sort of creates a question. And then also... And then the other side of that is the problem of the demented person or the schizophrenic or somebody who cannot function well, think properly, as we call properly, still existing on the planet in a physical reality of cause and effect.
Yes.
And
we take, we're bodhisattvas, we take care of them. So what's the problem there? We reach out to them and try to help them. We don't say they're enlightened. We certainly... because this enlightenment means is about being close to something, being intimate with a fear, without getting carried away by it, without magnifying it. That's the enlightenment, and the person with schizophrenia can't ever do that. Never. Unless they're I've known some people with schizophrenia who've gotten on their meds, who've done really well, then who've gotten off their meds and done really good practice. I'm saying a person with kind of schizophrenia my sister has can never do it.
So Bill, can I ask just a clarification? Did you say dementia as enlightenment or dementia and?
No, it's just a problem of, you know, you have delusion and then you have dementia.
Oh yeah, well, so dementia is being deluded about delusion. I mean, one way of looking at it.
Yeah.
It's delusion within delusion.
Yeah.
And
I guess the criteria is being able to have any sort of separation.
Right. That's right.
Delusion.
That's right.
See it as
right.
Delusion.
And there has to be separation for there to be intimacy. There cannot be intimacy if there's not a little separation. What else?
There can't be any intimacy without some separation.
Well, there has to be. This is, again, Dogen would say, without a little bit of duality, within non-duality, there is no sense of relationship. And intimacy comes. You can say oneness, but that oneness also, the very reason that you say that I'm bringing these together and these are one, they're one, but they're two. If they weren't two, there wouldn't be the intimate relationship between them. So Dogen is just, again, turning this whole oneness thing that goes on, like gone on in China for hundreds of years, and saying, well, be careful of that. It's because they're two that they're one.
So to take that a little bit further, then that would be the requirement to actually have a strong ego development.
Yep.
So that you actually
yep.
can.
Exactly. 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 Yep. Yep.
I thought it was self first.
Pardon?
I thought the way I understood you is that the duality helps the individual make observations about its own feelings and thoughts. That this distance allows view and then the.
Yes. That's what I was saying. That's what I was saying. Duality with flexibility, with without turning it into some tension between opposites, because it's tentative. These are focal points in something that's always moving and changing, which is really non-dual.
However, you talked about three approaches.
Uh huh. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, you can make them, you can stretch them, or you can just leave them be.
That's right.
Short.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Just thinking about the person with a mind that is, by Western standards, ill.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that's that person still has a chance in the beginner's mind approach, where, moment by moment, one moment sucks. Well, here's the next one. I don't know.
Uh-huh.
You know,
uh-huh. Yes.
With, so
sure.
The question is, do we have to expect that people who have an illness can't really experience enlightenment? Maybe we simply don't know.
Well, that's good. That's beginner's mind. We don't really know.
Yeah.
We don't really know. You don't really. I have worked with people again who were so sick with their schizophrenia that you would have thought, and I've seen them 20 years later. And unlike my sister, they've been blossoming and they're doing meditation. Mm-hmm. So you don't know. You don't know. Good. Good. So was there something else? Yeah? Larry?
I was at the peace demonstration on the Labor Day also.
You were there?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't. Did you see me?
No.
I didn't see you.
People.
Pardon?
I went to some in the late 60s.
Uh-huh.
It was really nice to be out there.
Uh-huh.
What I want to say is a couple of things, some observations. The police and rioter actually, they did look intimidating. They had the billy clubs drawn.
Yeah.
They had to toe on this rioter.
Yeah.
But actually, I saw an interesting thing, right? I didn't see any violence or whatever.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And so people couldn't go on the side streets because of the downtown. But I noticed some people engaging some of them, and I talked to one of them. And as soon as you approach them as a human being, as soon as you talk to them, then it wasn't like they were this kind of menacing.
Oh, sure.
Pretty friendly.
Sure.
So I didn't see that sort of.
Good for you.
But then later I saw, some of the news reports.
Mm-hmm.
But just, I wasn't intimidated by them. I didn't feel that sort of
Sure.
And the other thing I was going to say is there's a lot of really interesting science, creative science.
Uh-huh.
To a lot of these people. Great. But my favorite sign was actually, I think it was, the fellow said he was a meditator, so I didn't know what the tradition was. But he had a sign that said, don't hate the haters. I like that. Everybody has an agenda against peace demonstration. And that was pretty. Like, go to peace demonstration. You don't go to peace.
Thank you, Larry. Anything more? Just one more, okay.
I was also there, and that was a very interesting day of practice for me. Sunday I went to the Marshall training, and after an hour and a half of conversation, I was given a blue t-shirt, and suddenly I was official. Show up the day of, and I was just randomly assigned to the front line in front of the banner. And I didn't really know what I was getting into, and I had never marshaled a march before. But before I knew it, there I was, like, leading the march on the RNC. which is a really, really bizarre feeling. And it didn't really hit home that, like, estimates that there was, like, going to be 50,000 people that showed up. And so there we were walking, and then suddenly there's all these, like, cameras in my face. And it's just a really bizarre experience. And then you sort of go down until that sort of point right before the Excel Center. And for anybody that marched that day, there's, like, 8-foot-tall fences. And it goes from 4 lanes down to 2 lanes, down to, like, 1.5 lanes. And it's then there's about, there's probably a dozen and a half stormtroopers just sort of sitting there, and I guess I thought, well, that could be problematic. I guess my job is to stand between the people and the stormtroopers. I didn't really know what to do, especially, like, you know, I'm a fairly small human being, and those are big people. but I thought, well, you know, it's, I guess my job is just to sort of be a buffer. But yeah, the first thing I did was just sort of turned around and said, hi, I'm going to be standing here for a little bit. I think we have a common interest in making sure nobody gets all crazy. Just wanted to say hi. I know that, to engage them as human beings. And they joked, and you know, we were sort of in the same spot for a bit, and that was kind of interesting. But so I was there, and I saw, like, the most of the parade sort of go by, and one of the insights that I had was that on this sort of epic day of history, at the end of the day, it was a bunch of, like, stormtroopers standing there, pretty bored. And then the parade route was also fairly long, so there was a lot of the protesters that, as they're going through, I mean, they were tired and wouldn't have minded if it was a little bit shorter. But, like, these really intimidating stormtroopers, you're sitting there on the line, you see people, you know, a couple folks, they hear the same stuff over and over. Get out of here, you fascists, or all this stuff, and then you hear, like, a guy like, Sarge, my feet are really hot. What should I do about that? and it was really interesting that not only they humans, but they're... Who complains about their feet getting hot? it was
not
the, yeah. It was the closest I'd ever been to an assault rifle. but, like, my Zen practice served me really well, because at the end of the day, it was... You know, I didn't think they were going to end up using it on me. And if they did, there was nothing I could do about it anyway. But it was a very, very bizarre experience that day. And there was two slogans that I had with me that day that that served me well, and one of them was fear is in the future, and the other one was that fear only makes the wolf look bigger.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all.